George Harrison doing Woman Don't You Cry For Me. I guess he wrote that considering putting it on the All Things Must Pass album, but it didn't quite make the cut. Put it out later. This was an early take of it. I think it made it on another George album later on, like in 76, 33 and a third. But anyway, I hope you enjoy some of these rarities from the great George Harrison as we wrap up February and on to other things. But his music, for me, is always worth celebrating. I'm going to leave you with a take of a brown, old brown shoe that he did with Eric Clapton live. A cool live version of a song that he did late in the Beatles. Thanks for listening.
Shows Talk Is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti. Sorry to cut off Rob Tobias there. He does a great show. You can hear that twice a day. But I got an interview with a guy who's demonstrating at Thacker Pass in Nevada. And I didn't notice that train of thought started late there. I thought it started on time. Thacker Pass is a lithium mine, and this is the problem with, there's some problems with the way you go green. We need to go green the right direction within Earth's cycles, not in a linear extraction. You can't just substitute one extraction for the other extraction, so that's the problem that Will Falk and Max Wilbert are having at Thacker Pass, Nevada. So I'm going to talk to Max Wilbert at Thacker Pass, demonstrating trying to stop a lithium mine on here on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kpw.org. The opinions on this show are not that of the of Eugene Peaceworks or the other producers on KEPW or the management. So coming up here, Max Wilbert at Thacker Pass, Nevada, trying to stop a lithium mine where they're going to use sulfuric acid to evaporate with water and in a brine pond in the desert. They're going to use water to extract lithium when they can easily get it from the ocean. And Elon Musk is involved in this and everything. So coming up, Max Wilbert from Thacker Pass, Nevada. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Max, how's it going there in Nevada?
It's going good. Yeah, things are going pretty well up here. We've had a little bit of storminess the last couple of days, but we're getting through it and getting on with our campaign.
Yeah, is it cold?
It is. You know, temperatures are real up and down up here, but today the high was probably around 34, 35 degrees, and the low last night was probably 20 or maybe into the teens.
Yeah. So what's it like there? What's the species? What species are there at that site?
Well, we're in northern Nevada, which is part of the Northern Great Basin. And for those who aren't familiar with the region, this This part of the country is called the Sagebrush Ocean. And it's kind of a good way to describe it because, you know, it's basin and range country. There are tall mountain ranges. There are something like 44 mountain ranges in Nevada. And between them are these broad, flat valleys. And, you know, the mountains get pretty high. There's a 9,700-foot peak just to the east of us here in the east of Thacker Pass. And the sagebrush sort of rolls away from our camp down to the south in a way that, you know, it's a little bit similar to the ocean. It's incredibly beautiful. There's no trees up here. It's a very different environment to the Pacific Northwest. This is what's called sagebrush steppe by ecologists. So the sagebrush is the keystone species. They can grow to be over 100 years old. I don't know exactly how old they can get. I wouldn't be surprised if it's significantly older than that. And there are some really old sagebrush patches on this site. So to the north of us, there's one mountain range. To the south of us is another. And Thacker Pass is this broad saddle between these two mountain ranges. We're at about 5,225 feet of elevation. And then to the east and the west of us are these valleys that drop down about 1,000 feet lower. And there's some agriculture and some small communities in those valleys. So this place, Thacker Pass, is incredibly beautiful, and it's very ecologically important. It's an important migratory corridor for pronghorn antelope, the only antelope species in North America. It's habitat for the greater sage grouse, which is a bird species that is, its population has crashed significantly since colonization. It's dropped by about 97 to 99%. From its historic numbers. And this area of Thacker Pass and the surrounding regions is the best sage-grouse habitat left in Nevada. And part of that will be destroyed if the strip mine goes forward. You know, there's all kinds of other wildlife around here. There's nesting golden eagles. We saw a ferruginous hawk. There are mule deer. There are we've seen bobcat tracks. We've seen coveys of quail. There's all kinds of wildlife. We're expecting a lot of migratory birds to come through. I found a snakeskin shed walking through the sagebrush the other day. And, you know, that's just the wildlife that we've seen so far. So much of the life in the desert exists underground and lives in burrows and is nocturnal and so on. So there's a lot of life that we haven't seen. The pygmy rabbits, the jackrabbits, the burrowing owls, the kangaroo rats. There's just an abundance of species here, and when people come out to this place, they really tend to fall in love with it, and that's been my experience.
Right, it's a pretty harsh area, wilderness area, that it's amazing species can survive there at all. But so is anybody else, you're getting a lot of support, I'm seeing a lot of interviews that you're doing, is anybody else there with you? Are you getting support?
Yeah, there are about 8 people at camp right now. Our high point for numbers so far has probably been about 12, which is pretty good considering that it's the dead of winter still up here in the mountains. Spring is on its way, and we're expecting and hoping more people will come out. If anybody listening is interested in coming out to Thacker Pass, it's about a 7 to 9 hour drive from Eugene, depending on how fast you drive and the weather conditions. You go out towards Burns in eastern Oregon and then cut south on Highway 95. And we're expecting more and more people to come out as the weather gets nicer. We've had water protectors from up in the Seattle area, protectors of the Salish Sea, some veterans of Standing Rock. We've had folks coming out from the east as far as Indiana and Wisconsin. We've had folks coming in from California, Idaho, all over the country, and we're expecting that to grow. You know, this issue is so important right now because, you know, with the new administration, we're seeing this push to reject fossil fuels, to reject an economy based on oil and gas, at least somewhat. You know, I don't necessarily think that the Biden administration is all in on that type of stuff because they recognize how important oil and gas is to the economy. Unfortunately, but we're seeing this push towards electric vehicles, towards more wind and solar energy production. Those require electric batteries to store power for when the wind isn't blowing and when the sun isn't shining. So the lithium industry is poised to explode around the world. And, you know, we're kind of rushing into this blind. So many people think that these technologies are completely benign, that there are no problems with them. And we're trying to show that, you know, we can't just switch the fuel source for our cars, or more broadly for capitalism, and expect the planet to be saved. The problems are a lot more deeper than that. You know, we can't just change what's under the hood of the car or in the gas tank of the car and expect everything to be okay, because we live in this culture of overconsumption, of energy addiction, of perpetual growth. And no matter what the energy source is, no matter what the fuel is, that culture will destroy the planet regardless. And so we need to be having those conversations about what does a real transformation look like, and what kind of world do we want in the future? Because right now we're on track to just cause a new type of devastation, no longer for oil or perhaps for oil and as well lithium too, because, you know, oil production is at its highest level ever, and, you know, the boom in renewables doesn't seem to be shutting it down yet. I think we need to change our priorities as a society and address these problems directly, rather than trying to rely on the free market and technological innovation and private corporations to solve the problems for us. They're largely the ones who got us into this mess, and I don't think they're going to get us out of it.
Well, and so you've written a book on this. The website, if people want to get involved, is protectthackerpass.org. And so you've written a book on just this subject of what's it called, about the green revolution?
Yeah, the book is called Bright Green Lies, and its official release date is in a couple weeks. I'm selling it already on my own website, maxwilbert.org, and you can find it elsewhere. I actually live just outside of Eugene. I don't know if you said that in the intro, but I'm working on getting it into some of the local bookstores, Tsunami, and so on. And our book looks at the ecological and environmental problems caused by not just green technologies, but a lot of the green solutions that are put forward in the mainstream. You know, from my perspective as a grassroots environmental activist, you know, as somebody who's fought the fossil fuel industry for decades at this point, you know, people will accuse me of being a shill for the fossil fuel industry and being paid by them. And I wish they would take a look at my bank account and find out what my income stream really looks like. But, you know, I've climbed on top of heavy equipment to blockade tar sands construction in Utah. I've stood in front of coal trains to block them from delivering their coal to coal-fired power plants. I've been fighting tar sands pipelines for many years now, and the entire fossil fuel industry. So I don't see, you know, the status quo as something that we have to maintain. But what I see is that this idea of lithium, this idea of solar and wind as being the technologies that will save the day magically, I think those are lies. This is really the status quo continued. And in our book, Bright Green Lies, we look at how these technologies are actually produced, what raw materials are required, how the economics of these industries actually function in the world today. And, you know, as much as people want to talk about things like closed loop recycling and lithium ion battery recycling and using solar power energy to create more solar panels, that's not how anything happens today. Almost all of the raw materials from these technologies come from open pit strip mines, mountaintop removal mines, just like we see in Appalachia. That's where the copper comes from. That's where the steel and the iron ore comes from, that are in the electric cars that people are driving, in the solar panels that people are putting on their roofs, in the windmills that are going up all across the country that are causing, you know, major wildlife concerns for birds, but especially for bats. You know, and we look into these problems critically. And, you know, basically our conclusion in the book is that, like I was saying, we need more fundamental change. We need to, one, protect the natural world. We need to actually stop the destruction. So that means we need to stop pumping oil. We need to stop logging the forest. We need to stop overfishing the ocean. We need to stop with this industrial agriculture paradigm that, you know, relies on bulldozing everything and then, you know, planting one crop as far as the eye can see and just bathing it in pesticides and fertilizers. We need to do things in a different way. That's where a real solution lies. That's where we can start to reverse the ecological crisis that we find ourselves in. And, you know, the idea that technology is just going to save us, that's something that really comes from a marketing campaign. We've all been sold on this idea that wind and solar are these magical technologies. And we've all seen the commercials for the electric cars, you know, a happy family driving through a beautiful forest with clean air and nice quiet music playing in the background. And, you know, the advertising tells you, it programs you, right? This is the kind of future we should have. But that's not what a green future looks like. That's a dystopian future that's being sold as green. I think the world that we're headed towards honestly looks more like what you see in dystopian movies like the new Blade Runner film. I honestly thought that movie was pretty terrible, but one thing I thought was interesting about it at the beginning was, you know, it portrayed the eastern part of California, the desert regions of California on the east side of the Sierras, and it showed these concentrated solar power plants as far as the eye can see, fields of mirrors concentrating sunlight to run steam turbines and generate electricity. With this, you know, growth at all cost paradigm that we live in, that's the sort of world that we're headed towards. And, you know, friends of mine who are involved in fighting industrial solar projects in the Mojave Desert right now will just tell these horror stories of beautiful, pristine Mojave Desert areas that have escaped development for hundreds of years being bulldozed into dust for these solar projects of, you know, 5, 6, 7,000 acres. And, you know, stories of the desert tortoise, the threatened, federally listed threatened species, you know, being removed from the area and walking back and forth along the fence until they literally die of heat exhaustion, just trying to get back to their home. You know, that's what's happening right now, actually on the ground, you know, in the real world of industrial scale solar and wind energy. It's not this utopia that people are claiming is going to happen. And we need to be aware of these problems so that we can change the future.
Well, yeah, I lived in 29 Palms, and that's just it. They have plenty of rooftops there. There's sun there all over the place, and they, the city of 29 Palms, they just did not get that they could put solar panels on all the roofs that already exist, and instead they want to put a solar plant farm out there, and then run a line and charge people money for the electricity. It's the power companies out there, the corporate power companies out there, that are running the show instead of producing your own power on a rooftop. So the site there in Thacker Pass is only 5,000 acres. That doesn't seem like much. What will be the impact, though? What are they planning to do there?
Well, I think what people need to recognize as well is that the disturbance footprint of this mine is about 5,700 acres. That's the land that will actually be bulldozed, right? But that doesn't include all the indirect effects to the surrounding areas. The project site itself is over 10,000 acres in size, and it includes some quote-unquote exploration areas that could triple the size of the disturbance footprint in the future. So, you know, for those who don't know what 10,000 acres or 20,000 acres looks like, the open pit mine proposed for this area is about 2.3 miles long and half a mile wide. So, let's see, I'm trying to think of a Eugene landmark that people can imagine. You know, let's think about if you were at the Fred Meyer in West Eugene and you dug an open pit that stretched from there to the Kiva, right, in downtown Eugene, in the middle of downtown Eugene, or the bus station, and it was half a mile wide and 400 feet deep. So maybe it stretched from 11th down to 18th, maybe a little bit further south than that, and you dug a hole 400 feet deep there. That's the kind of area that we're talking about. And this isn't an urbanized area. This is wildlife habitat. This is critical habitat for all kinds of species. And then there are the indirect impacts. You know, they're blowing this place up using explosives. They're running heavy equipment 24 hours a day. They have spotlights on all the time. They have a sulfuric acid plant on site, which literally is bringing sulfur in from oil refineries to be used in processing the lithium. So, like I said, it's not separate from the fossil fuel economy. It's tied into it. They'll be burning more than 11,000 gallons of diesel fuel per day on the site. And, you know, there are a lot of species that even if their home isn't directly bulldozed, they won't tolerate that. They don't want to be anywhere near something like that. You know, for example, golden eagles, they're basically allergic to industrial civilization and human activity. They'll abandon their nests, they'll abandon their babies and go away because they can't handle it. They can't live in that kind of environment. And the same is true of sage grouse. Like I said, they're a species that is struggling. They've been almost wiped out. And this project is proposed for within less than half a mile of a sage grouse lek, which is their breeding grounds, are called leks. They meet there every spring and they do their dance and they have their mating and then they raise their young in the surrounding sagebrush. They won't tolerate any development nearby their lek, their mating area. And in fact, research has shown that any development within 5 miles of a sage grouse lek will cause reduced reproductive success. This is a species that evolved with massive wide open spaces available to them, with a very low human population density, with no industrial disturbance of any kind. And of course, this isn't even getting into issues with water. The project plans to pump something like 1.7 billion gallons of water per year out of, you know, Nevada's the driest state in the country. There's already the groundwater aquifers in this area are overdrawn every year. There's issues of water, like I said. There's issues with groundwater pollution. There's uranium, arsenic, antimony in the soil. Those things are pretty much locked up in the rock and are safe for now. But when you bulldoze all that, when you explode the soil, you put in your dynamite and you blow it up, and then you, you know, you process that soil and you extract the lithium and then pile all the waste rock in a giant mountain, all those harmful and dangerous material minerals and elements can be released into the groundwater. They can be released as dust. They can blow all over the landscape and into the surrounding communities, down into the agricultural zones and onto the crops that people and animals are relying on. So, you know, beyond the direct material impact, there's a massive impact that's indirect. And like I said earlier, this is a wildlife migration corridor, just like it's a path that, you know, humans use a path to go over a mountain range. You know, you go over Mackenzie Pass or Willamette Pass, Santiam Pass. The wildlife uses the passes too. It's the best and easiest way for the herds of antelope and deer to travel around. It's the best way for sage grouse to get from the Montana Mountains just north of here to the Double H Mountains to the south of us. You know, this has been a highway not just for indigenous peoples, but for wildlife for many thousands of years, and cutting that off will have catastrophic effects. And of course, it's not like this is happening in a vacuum. This is happening in a situation where wildlife is already struggling, where most of the valleys have been developed for agriculture, where there are other mines in mountains in the region. And so the wildlife is already heavily impacted. And this is just yet another insult, another assault to the biological integrity of the community.
Well, and they're using sulfuric acid as a desiccant in, like you're saying, in a desert area, a dry area. So where, after the water, they're using sulfuric acid to evaporate the water. And then where does the sulfuric acid go at that point?
Yeah, they're going to be burning sulfur on site to produce the sulfuric acid. I'm not actually sure about the chemical details of how they're using it. I was under the impression the sulfuric acid was being used with water to basically dissolve the lithium to break up the clay and the sort of soft rock soils that they're going to be digging up, dissolving them into a solution, and then they'll be precipitating the lithium out of that solution.
But the lithium is on the very bottom of the of the tank, so it's even more destructive because it's the heaviest element on of the that they're trying to get out, that they're trying to extract.
Yeah, there are definitely going to be some challenges. And one of the things is, this is a new process. So most of the lithium that's mined in the world today is called brine lithium. And what that means is you'll find it in these dry lake beds in places like Chile, Argentina, Bolivia, up in Tibet, in these regions similar to the Great Basin, where rivers and creeks flow into a basin and then they don't go out to the ocean. It just evaporates, right? And so you get these, this is how the Great Salt Lake was formed outside Salt Lake City. This is how salt flats are formed all over the world. And often in these places, you'll get high amounts of lithium dissolved in groundwater underneath the dry lake bed. And so most lithium mining today happens by putting a pipe down in the ground, pumping out that groundwater, and then evaporating all the water out. Basically, you put it in a very big, shallow pond, and you just let the sun beat down on it, and you're left with this very salty mixture that includes a lot of lithium, and then you refine the lithium out of that. This is completely different. This is lithium in clays and in rock and in soil. And so the process for extracting this lithium is unproven. It's a new technology that's being developed. The company has a testing and research facility in Reno, Nevada, which is about 2 hours from where we are. And they're still working on how to do this exactly. So it's unclear, you know, if it's going to be financially viable. It's unclear what the impacts are going to be on the surrounding land. This is not something that's been done before. And, you know, even if it were, all the other lithium mines in the world have a lot of environmental concerns associated with them. You know, the indigenous communities in Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile, up on the salt flat regions of these countries where the lithium mining takes place, are very upset about what's happening up there. Their water is being stolen en masse to be used as in these lithium mining operations. There have been human rights violations. There's ecological devastation. There's all kinds of issues. And, you know, the story is the same in Tibet. There have been cases of lithium mines poisoning rivers, you know, dispossessing entire communities that in these very rural areas rely on agriculture, rely on, you know, producing food from the land to sustain themselves. And all of a sudden these industrial projects come in and they make that impossible.
Well, and I'm seeing that Elon Musk is involved in this with in Bolivia. I think I can say it factually that he admitted that he caused a coup in Bolivia of the government in Bolivia to facilitate his lithium mine down there.
Absolutely. Yeah. When I was young, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan broke out, and the anti-war movement, of which I was a part of and still am a part of, was very clear that this was a war for oil, right? We're entering a new era of, global resource imperialism, in which one of the prized resources, in addition to oil and other things, is lithium. And that's what we saw in Bolivia. We saw a democratically elected leader being forced out and being replaced by a very far right-wing replacement. Jean Inez, I believe, was the woman's name. And one of her first moves was to privatize these highland regions in Bolivia and open them up to lithium extraction corporations, international businesses that aren't interested in saving the planet. They aren't interested in indigenous communities' rights. They aren't interested in sustainability. They're trying to make as much money as they can as quickly as they can. And, you know, luckily the Bolivian people wouldn't stand for that, and they got her out of there and replaced her again with a more left-leaning, more progressive government, unfortunately, the reality is, even the Morales government that was uprooted out of there still wants to extract lithium, still wants to facilitate resource extraction and ultimately the destruction of the land in this region, just wants to redistribute the proceeds and the wealth that's generated by that in a more equitable way. You know, I would rather have that than the alternative. But we need to stop destroying the planet entirely. It's not like we need to destroy the planet in a democratic and fair and equal way. We need to stop destroying the planet. And, you know, that's something that the Pink Tide in Latin America, you know, struggled with. So much of the wealth that was used to, you know, alleviate a lot of the poverty in the South American nations over the past couple decades came from very destructive mining operations, from oil extraction, from logging, and so on. And, you know, that's not an economic plan with a future. That's selling out the future. That's selling out the children for ephemeral wealth, for material prosperity in the present. And we need to be smarter than that.
I'm talking with Max Wilbert, who is demonstrating at Thacker Pass, Nevada, to stop a lithium mine. Who isn't this Indian land that this lithium mine is on?
Yeah, so this is traditional territory of the Northern Paiute and the Western Shoshone nations. This land was basically taken by the United States government throughout the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. There were a series of Indian wars through this region in which the indigenous communities fought back because the colonizers coming in, they were cutting down all the forests, the pinyon pines, the source of pine nuts for the indigenous tribes and nations throughout the Great Basin were being destroyed for the mining industry. Ironically, we should mention those trees were being cut to smelt the ores coming out of the silver and gold mines that really fueled the growth and founding of Nevada as a state. So indigenous people fought back. You know, the rivers were dammed, the beavers were trapped and killed. The land was really devastated in that period as the mining industry exploded and as more and more settlers came into the region and, you know, took up residence on what had been Paiute and Shoshone land. And that led to literal starvation among the indigenous peoples of the region. And, you know, they had no choice but to fight, and they did. And they fought very successfully in many cases, but ultimately, of course, they were fighting a war machine. You know, the U.S., the United States has never not been at war, and it's gotten very good at war, and, you know, it fights for keeps. The U.S. empire doesn't play around when it comes to armed conflict, and so we saw these indigenous communities moved into reservations, moved off their traditional lands, you know, forced by circumstances into signing treaties in many cases. The Western Shoshone actually never signed away their lands. And so the U.S. government allocated $175 million, I believe, back around 2006 to settle Shoshone land claims, Western Shoshone land claims. The Western Shoshone didn't take the money. And they said, we don't want your money, we want our land back. And so that money's sitting there. But the Supreme Court says that these land claims are, quote, considered extinguished. You know, and that's what happens when you use the courts of the colonizer to try and get justice. I don't think it's very likely to happen. That doesn't mean it's not worth fighting. But we're collaborating and in communication with a lot of different Northern Paiute and Western Shoshone folks, other indigenous supporters and allies from across the region. And, you know, people are very concerned about this project. There are burial sites right outside the project area. There are traditional cultural usage sites throughout the project area. There's obsidian in the soils here. It's a volcanic area, so there's obsidian. And that obsidian was worked and traded into stone tools by the indigenous people here for thousands of years. The oldest known petroglyphs in the world are not too far from, or not in the world, in North America, excuse me, are not too far from here, 15,000 years old around Lake Winnemucca. And so there's a long history of indigenous occupation of this area. And you know, people are concerned about this project.
Well, and so this would set a precedent, wouldn't it, if they did, if it's a long shot, but if there was a lawsuit by the tribal elders to reclaim their land, that has never been done before?
Yeah, there have been various lawsuits like that. I don't know of examples in this particular area right here, but one example that I'm familiar with is up in British Columbia, Canada. There are some nations, the Wet'suwet'en First Nation, they never ceded their land in a treaty to the Canadian government. And so by all accounts, under Canadian law and international law, this large portion of British Columbia should belong to the Wet'suwet'en. That case went all the way to the Canadian Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court actually sided with the Wet'suwet'en First Nation. However, then you come up against the reality that, you know, there are people living on these lands, there are businesses, there are communities, there are all kinds of forces. So essentially you have this situation where the Supreme Court affirmed some sort of ownership right or title to this land by the Wet'suwet'en, but that hasn't actually resulted in anything changing on the ground. And, you know, there are layers to colonial power structures. There are layers to how capitalism and empire functions. And, you know, I don't think we can expect a judge to solve all those problems for us, unfortunately.
Yeah, and so nature has rights, too. Isn't there a rights of nature lawsuit? Were you involved in the Colorado River rights of nature suit?
Yeah, I was involved in that project a little bit. My friend Will Falk, who's up here with me at Thacker Pass and who I founded this this camp with, he was one of the main organizers as part of that project. And that effort was the first major lawsuit in U.S. history in which a major ecosystem, the Colorado River, actually filed a lawsuit against the state of Colorado, alleging that its rights were being violated. And that happened through Will and some other friends of ours acting as next friends of the river, basically acting on behalf of the river and suing the state of Colorado. You know, what happened there was the case was thrown out. And in fact, sanctions were threatened against the lawyers who were involved in the case. And sanctions is sort of a nice way of saying, you know, if you don't stop with this kind of BS, then we're going to fine you $50,000 and take away your law license. So, you know, you see in these type of cases the brutal reality of power. In our legal structure, nature is considered property, and it doesn't have rights. We don't have any responsibilities to nature under our law. It's considered property, something that people can do with as they wish. And, you know, that's how our whole structure of law was set up. The law that actually governs the mining that's being proposed at Thacker Pass is an 1872 mining law that has been the same since literally the colonization of Nevada and of the West was occurring. That's the law that is still being used. And so, you know, we've heard from people inside the Bureau of Land Management, which technically manages this public land that's about to get privatized for 50 years for a corporation's exclusive use to profit from. And these people inside the BLM tell us that, you know, the BLM actually doesn't have that much power in this situation. The BLM actually can't really say no to a project like this. It's very, very difficult for them to say no because the law was written and set up in such a way to facilitate extraction and put all the power in the hands of the corporations. And you know, it's not much different today than it was in 1872 when that law was passed. You know, armed people backed by the full force of the state are going to come and try and blow up the mountains and leave devastation behind them. And, you know, a small group of people are trying to stop it.
And indeed, the BLM has approved the Thacker Pass.
Yeah, on January 15th, which was the day we launched our protest camp here, they issued their record of decision, which basically means their permit for the project. There are still a few outstanding permits from the state of Nevada and one for golden eagles from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, authorizing the company to incidentally kill, harass, or harm golden eagles. So they're waiting on those permits. There are these two lawsuits pending, one by a local rancher and one by a group of four environmental groups. So those may slow down the project. I, as you can probably tell, don't have too much faith in the legal system. That doesn't mean we shouldn't use it. I think we should fight using all means at our disposal. But we really need people to come out to Thacker Pass, to be on the ground, to engage in direct action and protest and be ready to stand against the machines when they show up to destroy this place. I think we need to, you know, force a moral reckoning around these issues, and that will require a lot more people joining us. So, you know, I know you said it earlier, but protectstackerpass.org, you know, get in touch with us. We have directions, we have packing lists, we have information about what's needed at camp, and we would really love to have some more folks from the Eugene area out to be part of this.
Well, because isn't it in our own, at the risk of being talking about self-interest, and isn't it in our own best interest to have nature? Can we survive without nature, humans? And don't we have a responsibility to take care of the earth?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And this project with the harm, the poisoning of groundwater, the drawdown of the aquifers, the destruction of this beautiful habitat that, you know, we've seen people hunting behind the camp, hunting birds in these little canyons, just like people have hunted for their food in Thacker Pass for thousands and thousands of years. The thing about intact habitat is it provides clean water. It provides building materials. It provides materials to make clothing. It provides food, it provides medicine, it provides the necessities of human life. And none of that is provided after you've blown up a mountain, after you've poisoned a mountain, after you've taken all the water and filled it with sulfuric acid and uranium and left a mess that will be there for who knows how many hundreds or thousands of years after the fact. There are mining operations that took place during the Roman Empire that are still so toxic that people can't really spend any time in those areas, that you can't grow crops, that you don't want to graze any sort of livestock or goats or anything around those areas because of mining that took place thousands of years ago. You know, so these are the serious impacts that we need to be aware of. And I think as a society, we need to figure out a better way. We need to use less. You know, our grandparents lived through the Depression, and they lived through periods when they had to restrict their lifestyles. They had to restrict their consumption because of the circumstances they found themselves in. We're entering this new era of extreme climate change, the sixth mass extinction event, ecological collapse across the planet, the oceans collapsing, insect populations collapsing, songbird populations collapsing, amphibians across the board. You know, our children are not going to have a future unless we figure out a better way to live. And you know, I keep saying it, but for everyone who thinks that lithium is a key to a green energy transition, we are not going to save the world by destroying it. We're not going to save the world by blowing up mountains. We're going to save the world by changing our society from the bottom up.
Well, so what would that look like, though? You're not saying to be, we don't need to all be self-sufficient. The way I got into sustainability originally was I was going to try and I tried to live out off the land. And, as you know, you got to be like Grizzly Adams out there to do that. So what we can't just drive our cars, even if they're electric. We can't just drive our cars haphazardly. What will it look like? What do you think our society would look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're communal creatures. We can't survive alone. We can't survive without each other. You know, many of the punishments in traditional cultures, the worst punishments were banishment, because, you know, banishment meant basically you were going to die. You know, you can't survive without the group, not for the long term. And, you know, but I think that we need to make do with a lot less. We need to localize our societies. You know, people talk about local food movements and, you know, trying to eat within a 100-mile radius of where you live, you know, a food shed or something of that nature. How about we talk about 100-mile technologies, right? How about we talk about you don't get to use a technology unless all of its components come from your direct area, your technology watershed or what have you. And, you know, that's restrictive. But we have been living in this era of energy glut. You know, we've been living in this era when oil has fueled this economy, and we're all used to lifestyles that, you know, surpass the lifestyles of kings, you know, thousands of years ago. We need to get used to living with a lot less. And in many cases, I think that will actually improve our quality of life. You know, when you don't have so many screens around you, you have to actually make friends with the people in your community. You have to actually have a relationship with the soil that produces your food. You have to actually have some sort of relationship with the springs and the rivers that create your water. because, you know, you're not getting your goods from a grocery store. You're getting what you need to survive from the land around you, you know, not as some sort of rugged individualist, but as a community, figuring these things out together. You know, and there are so many examples. I mean, just in the Eugene area, you can look at, you know, there's such a strong permaculture movement. There's such a strong back to the land movement going back for many years. You know, we have answers about how to live in more sustainable ways, natural building techniques, passive solar to heat your houses, rocket stoves and natural construction. All of these things are not technically difficult, but what we need, the hard part, is the political will, the social will to change our society. And I think that requires getting organized. That requires, you know, building organizational structures, becoming part of different groups and taking political action. You know, I think that we need a permaculture party or a degrowth party in this country, you know, that advocates for these things at the city level, at the county level, at the state level and beyond, and starts to, you know, move funds and resources from our governments into these sort of relocalization projects. You know, we shouldn't be subsidizing electric cars and lithium. We should be subsidizing salmon restoration in the Willamette and taking down the dams, because that's a food source, you know, that's a source of life and vitality that has existed for millions of years and could support humans for millions more. You know, lithium, investing our money and our time and our energy into these sort of techno fixes, it's just going to backfire on us, you know, like all the other technologies have. You know, oil, it seemed like such a great boon to people, and it turned out to be this savage wound to the planet, this savage wound to the climate. It's going to be no different with lithium extraction or solar panels and so on. We need to make do with less. We need to organize. We need to change our way of life. We need to change our political system. And, you know, that's not easy. I recognize that I'm talking about a fundamental transformation in our society, but that's the work of our time. That's what we're here to do. You know, we're living in this existential moment for the human species. And the question is, you know, do we have the courage? Do we have the strength? Do we have the capacity to do these things? And my experience has been, you know, doing this work, doing radical activism and community organizing for the past decade. My experience has been, you know, being involved in this political struggle is the best thing that even ever happened to me. Even though it's really hard, even though we lose so often, even though it's so challenging, even though sometimes it takes me up on a mountain, freezing my ass off, you know, at 10 degrees in 50-mile-an-hour winds, you know, there's a lot of difficulties and there will be many more in the future, but you can't ask for more meaningful work to do with your life. So, you know, I hope people will try and find purpose in this and, you know, set aside all the excuses and the self-limitations that you've been clinging on to for so many years. You know, it's time for us all to step up.
Yeah, I don't want to be dependent on a lithium mine for my happiness. But there's individual change is only goes so far. Who when I got into sustainability, I didn't get it that these corporations destroy stuff and then they profit from the reconstruction. Who is responsible for this for destroying the planet, do you think?
That's a great question. I mean, ultimately, I think these are systemic issues. You know, you can point to the CEOs, the board of directors of these companies, but the individuals are largely replaceable because we have a whole culture that creates this sort of ideology of growth, of extraction. And, you know, business schools and engineering schools are just pumping out an endless stream of people who can fill those roles and be the next folks, you know, to head up the next lithium mining company, the next strip mining company. I think that's why I think we need systemic change. And that doesn't mean we don't, you know, we don't point out and pursue and shame and stop the individuals who are running things now. But, you know, whether you want to talk about the ruling class or the bourgeoisie, if you're a Marxist, or whether you want to talk about the state and state power, if you're an anarchist, or whether you want to talk about, you know, the colonizing forces, if you prefer an indigenous analysis of these issues, whether you want to talk about civilization, industrial civilization itself, the culture of empire, if you are focused on the anti-war analysis. I think all these different things are getting at the same sort of root. It's a culture of domination, a culture of profit and accumulation, a culture that's not based on relationship, that's based on brutality. And that's what we have to get away from. Jack Forbes, indigenous writer, called it the Wetiko sickness, a psychological disease that causes people to just want more and more and more. And that's the disease that is basically infecting the majority of our culture. And we need to inoculate people. We need to change the culture, and we need to actually do the political work, the direct action work, the organizing work of stopping the destruction before it's too late.
All right, Max Wilbert of ProtectThackerPass.org. So people can send you money, too, if they can't drive out there. They can also send you money on ProtectThackerPass.org. Is there anything else you want to say to close it up?
Yeah, I would just say once again, our number one need is folks to come out here. The weather is pretty harsh, as I said, right now, but we're expecting it to get better and better. It is incredibly beautiful out here. If you love the wild, if you love the natural world and the beauty it's just almost unbelievable. So I really recommend that people come out to the site. You will fall in love. And once you fall in love, you're accountable. You're part of something. You're part of a family. And, you have to do something to protect your family. And so I hope you'll come out here and, become kindred with the Thacker Pass.
All right, Max Wilbert, stay warm and safe out there in Thacker Pass, Nevada, trying to stop a lithium mine.
Thanks so much, Curtis.
One more thing, the BLM tried to kick you off. Are you able to stay there?
They have a 14-day camping limit on BLM lands. We exceeded that at the beginning of our stay here and stayed for about 23 days. Our lawyers were pushing back against them, trying to kick us out. Eventually, we did comply, and since then, we've been rotating people in and out of the camp, so we haven't had any issues. Nobody's breaking any laws up there, and so the BLM hasn't been giving us any trouble. But we'll see what the future holds. We want to stop this place, and we're willing to take some risks to do that.
All right, man, rock on. Thanks for your time, and thanks for doing what you do.
Thank you, Curtis. Take care.
All right, bye.
off and break the structure off. His blood still flows in the gutter. I'm not taking photos. The rest of the sun kicks open the shutter. Set the mood and stick your mood on our chest. Step his gutter step. Barber left him on the fascist. Yeah, instead of the federal man who pulled schemes on the tree and put it to an end. You better beware of retribution with my war. 2020 vision, filled with metaphors. Devils at work, keeping people calm. You know they murder that and try to blame it on Islam. They turn the power to the have-nots and they came to shot.
me escaping from this zoo.